Our next case is A21-0664, R.S. Fridley et al. Versus a host of respondents. The first question I want to ask is, Ms. Wickham, is everyone here who wanted to be here?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And then finally, before we start, I did want to know from Ms. Reithoff, and I hope I pronounced this right, Mr. Vivian, you'll be splitting your time. How much for who?
First of all, you're right, Your Honor, it's Vivian. It's just like the woman's name with Y's instead of I's. It looks much more intimidating than it actually is. And we're going to split our time, 12 minutes for me and 3 for Ms. Reithoff.
Thank you very much. All right, then I'm going to call this case to order. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, and then respondents will be splitting their time as already indicated. And then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. As all parties are, I'm sure, are also aware, this is a Zoom argument. We are making an audio recording of this argument. However, a private recording by any of the attorneys or parties or anyone who's simply observing on Zoom or listening is strictly prohibited by our rules. So please don't do that. With that then, we'll hear for counsel for the appellants, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Ellen Aarons Wickham. I represent the appellants here today. The circumstances in this complaint arise out of a commercial real estate transaction where the appellants purchased a special purpose medical facility for $6.7 million. This was a big investment. Three years after the purchase, however, the makeup of the building was very different than what they thought they were purchasing. One tenant had completely abandoned the facility. One tenant had entered into an unauthorized sublease, and there was significant damage to the building.
Ms. Wickham, I just want to point out, I can assure you that all of us are very familiar with the underlying facts that led up to the purchase agreement and the closing on this property back in, I think it was 2015. Right. You have 12 counts that are alleged, and I'd like to just get into it because you've got an enormous amount of ground to cover in the short time that you have on appeal. You know, the bulk of your complaint is based on fraud-based claims. And out of your fraud-based claims, I'm a little bit, I'm
skeptical.
I feel I don't understand where you're going at as far as the failure to disclose material facts. I mean, I understand you've got your three different fraud-based. I've got so many notes from where it's at. You've got the fraud based on the affirmative representations, you've got failure to disclose, and you've got fraudulent inducement. But can you talk for a while, please, about the failure to disclose? My review of Minnesota cases on that show very little guidance. And it seems to me that you want us as an appellate court to step out and address a type of action that Minnesota courts have not embraced.
Sure, I'd be happy to address that. So the duty or the failure to disclose arises in this case. There are a couple of options. In this case, it arises out of the special knowledge. And as you mentioned, Judge Werke, there are very few cases that address that particular relationship. I think what's important to know here is that just because appellate cases don't address it doesn't mean that the special relationship doesn't exist. Special knowledge. The special knowledge here is available when there are parties to a contract and one has superior knowledge that's not known to the other, and the party is aware of the other's reliance. So the knowledge here is that the TCO respondents and the GOND respondents knew that they were constructing the TCO Blaine building at the time that they entered the sale into the TCO Fridley building.
Your clients and the respondents are all sophisticated business folks, are they not?
Yes.
And so there's no imbalance of power. So why couldn't your clients with due diligence have determined what now you're complaining was not disclosed?
So they did do their due diligence, and part of that was the meeting in April 2015, where they
Some due diligence. Are you saying they could not have found out what they now know?
That's correct. They specifically asked about it, and I think one of the central issues here is they specifically asked, it looks like, and I'm paraphrasing from paragraph 58 of the complaint, it looks like you're growing and expanding. We see new buildings coming up all the time. What does this mean for the Fridley building? And at that time, affirmative misrepresentations were made that the tenants intended to stay in the building, that they intended to renew their leases, that Fridley was designed specifically for them and they had no intention of leaving.
Right. Yeah, wouldn't that be more closely related to your other fraud theories, you know, the fraudulent inducement and so on, rather than, and I guess what I'm getting at is the sophistication of the parties and the fact that that we don't recognize this in Minnesota doesn't mean that there couldn't have, due diligence aside, there could have been something in a contract that would say, you know, no building that's going to be in competition, you know, like malls do, where they say no more donut shops, we only get one, or something of that nature within a radius. I mean, there's other protections that are available, wouldn't there have been? And that's why I'm saying if they're sophisticated parties and there's no imbalance of power, why would we thrust this on Minnesota litigants to start addressing these type of issues?
Well, I think the answer to that is that this is a little bit of a different circumstance because they were specifically asked about those issues and they made affirmative representations.
Well, they were no one specifically asked them. So are you going to build another medical building across the street? I mean, I think it would be a different case if you specifically asked them that, or they specifically said that. And I agree with Judge Werke. I mean, this problem could have been solved by having a restriction in the purchase agreement about, you know, competition or, you know, no new buildings or anything like that. And you didn't do that. I would like to get to a different issue because I share Judge Werke's concerns, which is, you know, I understand what you think the fraud is, and it's material representation of a present intent. And I guess I do have a concern that, like, you know, the purchase was closed in 2015 and this whole, you know, building stuff didn't happen until 2018. So I have a little concern about that this is more like a representation as to future events as opposed to a present intention. So what can you do to help me on that point, Ms. Wickham?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would point you to paragraphs 58 and 61 of the complaint, where there are allegations that at the time of the sale and closing of the TCO Fridley building, that the TCO respondents were actively planning to build the TCO Blaine facility. This isn't a case where they went and purchased an existing building and modified it. This was a completely new space. It was, they had to buy the land. There's
So even if I go by your allegation, you know, they were planning to build a building. Okay. You know, that's different from, like, they had, you know, we've planned it. You know, I've got a copy of the architect's drawing of this building and, you know, I'm hiding it from you. I don't know if that's enough. I'll just say I have a concern about that.
I understand. And I think that allegation needs to be considered with the fact that as part of the plan is not only just the physical building, but part of the business plan of the building was that it would replace the Fridley building. And the tenants, at least the TCO, the two major tenants who occupy 95 or 96% of the space, would leave the Fridley building, which they did, and go to the Blaine building.
On that subject, there's nothing in their leases that would prohibit them from doing just what they did, is there?
There's not a specific term in the lease that addresses continuous occupation. And so the appellants relied on the statements in April 2015 that they were intending to fulfill the terms of their lease, which at the time the appellants understood to include continuous occupation.
That was the date of the purchase agreement. How about at closing? Was anybody asked at the date of closing whether anything has changed?
I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you that the April 2015 meeting and the closing were about 6 weeks apart. So it wasn't a huge amount of time.
Can I have you address, you've got your breach actions, breach of contract actions too. And, you know, Minnesota being, I mean, the matters, your case was dismissed under Rule 12, so we need to look at some specificity as far as how you pled. On the breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing, you're talking about contractual duties that were hindered, but you don't say specifically what it is. Can you expand on that, or can you tell me where it is in our record that we could find that as far as piecing it together and passing it through the pleading standard?
Sure. I understand. Yes. So I think the first part is that the pleading standard for breach of contract is not the same specificity that's required for fraud. Minnesota, as the court is very well aware, has a liberal pleading standard. That doesn't mean that all complaints pass through that gate, but in this case, I believe it does. There are not a lot of specifics in the complaint. I do think there's enough to survive a motion to dismiss, but what I can tell you for context is I can give you an example. So a cleaning service was contracted, you know, between the cleaning service and the appellants, and the tenants who were not a party to that contract were directing the cleaning service where to go, what to do, that sort of thing. The TCO tenants.
It would be a separate contract, and don't we as litigator, I mean, isn't it in Minnesota a requirement that there be the same contractual relationship in order to have that kind of a breach?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, I'm sorry, Judge Connolly, I interrupted, but we were thinking exactly the same thing. I mean, you could sue the service provider.
Yeah, I mean, I guess how is whatever the tenants did with the vendors a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing by TCO people?
So they have breached the lease agreement by interfering with the appellant's relationship, and they have interfered by, I'm sorry, I think I'm getting this confused with a tortious interference claim.
Right. That's different. I mean, I kind of get that. A separate part, but apart from the whole vendor thing, is the MRI equipment, right? Mm-hmm. And that you use for the breach of the covenant of good and fair dealing and the breach of the contract, the purchase agreement. So I guess my first question is, you know, at closing, the MRI equipment, well, let me ask you, start. Do you think the MRI equipment is a fixture?
Yes.
Okay. The MRI equipment was delivered at closing, correct?
Well, that was appellant's understanding. The respondents later disputed that. I mean, it's not the MRI system.
I mean, between 2015, I mean, if the MRI equipment was not delivered at closing in 2015, wouldn't we have expected you to complain about it sometime before 2018?
Right. So the MRI equipment is a giant piece of equipment. It's not like a stapler, you know, that it can move around the building.
I agree. I get
okay.
it.
It was delivered at closing in the sense that it didn't change its location.
So explain to me then how there was a breach of contract. I mean, if that stuff was delivered at closing as required by the purchase agreement, I don't see how there's a breach of the lease. Now, I understand, you know, that's different from, you know, someone took it away, and we'll get to that. But I don't see, you know, if it was delivered at closing, I don't see how the agreement was breached. And I also don't see how it was breached if it was later removed. It was later removed. That's not a breach of the contract. That might be something else. And it also depends on who removed it, but I don't see a breach of the contract if the if you got the MR equipment at closing and it was later removed 3 years later.
The breach is that the NSOP defendants said that they owned the MRI equipment and it was therefore going to transfer to appellants. And then that was later disputed.
Okay, so what you're saying is that you had enough in your pleadings that it should have survived the motion to dismiss.
Yes, and the, you know,
just because it's a question of fact.
It is a question of fact. You're right, Judge Werke. And I think that's one of the concerns we have with the district court's order is that there were factual determinations that were made or assumed that are contrary to the pleadings, and all the pleadings or the complaint in this case needs to be construed as true under the Wall standard.
Who removed, in your complaint, who removed the MRI equipment?
At the time the complaint was filed, we understood it to be the OPPA tenants. We later learned that it was the sublessor, the unauthorized sublessor that removed it.
MOSC?
No, MOSC is also a TCO tenant. It was the sublessor, I believe, does business under Suburban Imaging.
And you brought a separate action against them, didn't you?
Yes.
I think it was that separate action. Was that dismissed or is that still pending?
So a summary judgment order was issued and a claim based on the removal of the MRI equipment was dismissed, but the summary judgment order granted in part and denied in part the summary judgment motion. So there's no final decision in that case. And on the remaining claims, it's going to trial in April.
But so getting back to the question, so if you're now saying the sublessee removed the MRI equipment, well, first of all, are you saying that?
That's my understanding, but that is not in the complaint because that wasn't known at the time. So on the face of the complaint, I believe it says that OPPA removed the MRI equipment. Which
right, but I mean, you know, I mean, if that's not true, I mean, if that is no longer your position, then...
Yes, that is okay. Right. My understanding is that the facts as we know them now is that the sublessor removed the
Okay, so MRI if that's equipment. The case, if the sublessor removed the equipment, how is that a breach of the agreement by the TOC people, the TCO people?
Because they didn't have authorization to do that.
Well, then sue the subtenants.
Well, that is part of
you know, at that point, you own the building. So if someone takes stuff from the building, how is that the seller's problem? I mean, isn't that, well, it's first of all, I think it's your problem, and it's also, you know, get this, you know, go after the subtenants for conversion. I don't see how that is the seller's. I don't see how that creates a claim against the seller.
Right.
Explain
and again,
why am I wrong?
I think because the seller represented that the MRI, according to the appellant's allegations, that the MRI system was a fixture that transferred with the property.
And it did at and closing, it, right?
Right, but the appellants didn't truly have control over that equipment as the NSOP defendants represented.
What do you mean they didn't have control? Was this an item that was supposed to be bolted down? Does it come in on wheels? What's the nature of this product?
Yes, my understanding is that it's a huge piece of equipment that requires special ventilation and electricity. And so when it was removed, it caused significant damage to the facility.
Judge Conley, I know the time has expired. May I ask a question?
Yes, and then I have some more of my own. Okay. Go ahead, Judge.
And I'm going to preface it by saying I look like I'm rather ethereal, and I will lay blame to the litigants in this matter. I had to move to a different space so that I had room for all the files and documents that come from this litigation. My question is this on the conversion issue, because the way you've sued it out, and this is what bothers me about the conversion issue, you've sued all of the respondents on that basis. And I can't for the life of me figure out how the appellant Goggins would have anything to do with the MRI appropriation. So it appears that in some respects you've oversued, you've just blandly just sued everyone without looking at each of the respondent parties for their own individual culpability, if any. There was a question there, if you can follow it.
I think your question is, why are the Gan defendants responsible for conversion? And the answer is that they caused the appellants to overpay and lose the benefit of their bargain for the building.
Right, but then there's another question. We don't recognize overpayment in Minnesota, so you're asking us to stretch our law again, or can you give me some authority for that?
Sure. I think that the cases that appellants, the published cases, don't go quite as far as respondents say that they do. And the there have been no cases that I could find that rely on HALA or TCI Business Capital to reduce, or excuse me, to dismiss a claim for conversion based on the fact that it was, quote, only money that was converted.
Thank you, Judge Connolly, for letting me ask the additional questions.
No, thank you, Judge Werke. That was one of the questions I wanted to ask. So I'm gonna ask a couple more questions. So I wanna shift to, so the tortious interference with the prospective business advantage, you know, the discontinued lease by MOSC, I mean, again, how is that TRO's fault? I mean, the lease is the lease, or excuse me, you know, the assignment of leases said, here are the leases, they run for this period of time, you know, and then they don't. I don't see how MOSC leaving the lease early or leaving the lease whenever the lease expired is TRO's fault. Explain to me why I'm wrong, Ms. Wilson.
So TCO is responsible for that because they built the Blaine building and basically had MOSC breach their lease or at least move out of the building.
Which they were allowed to do pursuant to their lease, right?
That is, I understand that to be respondent's position. Our position is that
did the lease end in, did the MOSC lease end in 2000? When did the MOSC lease end?
It has not ended.
Okay, so they left early?
Yes.
So they breached the lease?
Yes.
Okay, and so you're saying that that's TRO's fault because they induced them to breach the lease? Is that in the complaint?
Yes. TCO built the Blaine building with the specific intent that MOSC would leave the Fridley building and move to the Blaine building.
Well, if there's a breach of lease, is that inured to your clients? They can pursue that breach of lease?
Yes. I believe that's in that related litigation. It's also part of this claim as well, this case.
And your position, so on the unjust enrichment, I mean, you've pled breach of contract and you're pleading this in the alternative, but presumably at some point you're going to have to make up your mind and then one or the other is going to go away, right?
Yes.
But you're saying it's not now.
I think that's correct. Right. That's what I'm saying. It's not now. This is a pleading stage case. Plaintiffs are allowed to plead in the alternative. The fraud claims, one of the remedies asked for is rescission, which would eliminate the contract, leaving unjust enrichment a viable remedy. So there's just no reason to dismiss it at this point.
The other question I had, going back to the fraud, and I'm sure this is going to make Ms. Rytoff happy. You want to explain to me how the brokers are liable when all they did was sit in the room and nod their heads?
Yes, I do.
Go right ahead.
The brokers, the allegations in the complaint are that the brokers also knew that the TCO Fridley building was basically going to be obsolete. They agreed and didn't contradict the statements that that were made during that meeting.
Have we ever held, are you aware of any case, Ms. Wickham, where we've ever held that not making a representation at all and just being in the room while someone else makes a representation is enough to get you for fraud? The person is just kind of sitting here nodding their heads. I mean, doesn't it have to be a representation? And I don't think a nodding your head is a representation.
I think I don't have the case right at my fingertips, and I'd be happy to address that on reply, but I think the difference here is that when you know that something is false and you don't speak up.
You know, that I think that gets into whether there's a fiduciary relationship or not. So anyway, I will tell you flat out, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I have serious concerns as to how the, I hope I pronounced their names right, the Gogan defendants can remain in this lawsuit. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you.
The one question I wanted to go back to was on the fraud. Okay, so one of the elements of fraud is reliance. And I guess what I'm having some concern is, you know, how can you have justifiable, you know, the purchase agreement is the purchase agreement, and it concluded the representations about the fixtures and the building and the leases. And, you know, it had a merger clause. So how can you explain to me how there can be justifiable reliance on these misrepresentations when the purchase agreement kind of trumps it all? So explain to me the reliance issue. I'm having trouble understanding how you can rely on these representations in when there's the existence of the purchase agreement, which specifically seems to specify what the representations are as to this property. Go right ahead, Ms. Wood.
Well, I think reliance, just first of all, I think reliance is a question of fact. And on this complaint, there are, this is a, you know, we're at the pleading stage and it's an element of fraud. I see you shaking your head. You want
no,
me
no,
to
I agree with you. I get it.
Okay.
I totally agree with you. We're at the pleading stage. I got that the second I picked up the brief.
Right. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought there.
So are you saying then, because it's at the pleading stage, there's enough to plead reliance because you said there's reliance?
Yes, and I think, I think there's more than just there's reliance.
But how can there be reliance when the purchase agreement governs the relationship between the parties as to the as to this building?
Well, the purchase agreement states that, I believe it's the purchase agreement or the bill of sale that states that the no tenants have threatened to breach the lease, which are the allegations say that the tenants knew that they were intending to breach the lease. And I'll leave it there.
Well, then. Fair enough. I just going over my notes. There were a lot of counts.
I know.
Well, that'll have to do. So, all right. Thank you very, very much, Ms. Wickham. Obviously, we've gone over our time, but I think it was very well spent for the panel. We'll now hear from counsel for one of the respondents.
May it please the court, Mark Vivian on behalf of the TCO respondents, Your Honor. And I'd like to start my time, if I may, correcting what I think are at least three misstatements made by Ms. Wickham on her presentation. And I understand that she does not have the benefit of having represented her clients in the other litigation, but some of the things she said just frankly are incorrect. And I'll start with the discussion of whether MOSC breached its lease. And the answer to that is no, it did not breach its lease.
They didn't leave early?
They did leave early, but Judge Fountain Lindbergh ruled in the other case that there is no continuous operation clause and they had no obligation to stay in the premises and operate. And I'll point out that Ms. Wickham's clients chose to start three different lawsuits. Two of them got consolidated and then they started this fraud lawsuit. So to some extent, they're trying to take advantage of the fact they have these scattershot allegations, but Judge Fountain Lindbergh on summary judgment considered the continuous operation argument and flatly rejected it. There is no continuous operation clause in either the MOSC lease or the TCO lease. MOSC has not breached the lease. And to the extent they want to appeal Judge Fountain Lindbergh's ruling, they can do that after the trial, but they shouldn't be allowed what would essentially be an expedited appeal of that decision here. The second thing I want to talk about is the MRI, and I'm just sort of going in reverse chronological order from the argument. suburban
so
radiology.
Before you do that, Mr. Vivian, I just want to make sure. So is MOSC still, so they're not there, but are they paying rent?
Yeah, every month.
Okay, I got it. So that's why that's why there's no breach of the lease. I understand now. Thank you. I apologize.
They're not there, but they pay every month, Your Honor.
There you go.
The MRI, suburban radiology removed it, not TCO. And Your Honor's asked about, well, you can sue.
Were they a tenant?
They were a subtenant of ours.
A subtenant of, thank you.
There was some discussion, well, can't you sue suburban radiology? And the answer to that, of course, is yes. Matter of fact, they did. They sued him in one of the first two cases, and the court ruled against them on summary judgment. They could sue them. They did sue them, and they lost. So it just shouldn't be part of this case.
Well, was the MRI a fixture?
No. And the judge found, Lindbergh specifically found, it was not a fixture. And
what does the purchase agreement say about the MRI equipment?
It doesn't say anything about it. The only thing it says about fixtures, and it's not a fixture, Judge Font Lindbergh made that very clear in her ruling, fixtures owned by the seller of the building go to Ms. Wickham's client. A, it's not a fixture. B, it was not owned by the seller of the building. It was owned by TCO, and then it was transferred to suburban.
Who offered, radiology. Then in that case, who offered to sell it to Ms. Wickham's clients? Who I seem to recall someone said, would you like to buy this stuff? Who said that?
I think that was TCO, Your Honor, before it got sublet to Suburban Imaging.
Well, how could they say that if they didn't own it and it wasn't a fixture?
TCO owned it. So there's two different entities here, Your Honor. The entity that Ms. Wickham's client purchased from is abbreviated NOSP, Northwestern Orthopedic Surgeons Partnership. It's a completely separate legal entity from my client, TCO. So the MRI equipment was owned by the tenant, TCO. It was never owned by Northwest Orthopedic Surgeons Partnership. And Judge Fountain Lindbergh also ruled on that, Your Honor. And just to be clear, it is a very large piece of equipment. It's not a fixture. It's essentially a big magnet that sits in the middle of the room and gets plugged into the wall. And it's so big that you do have to remove a section of the wall to take it out.
So we have the purchase agreement. It isn't in the purchase agreement. It's not on property to be purchased. And that's your story and you're sticking to it. It wasn't intended to be a part of the transaction.
Correct.
Regardless of whether there may have been some communications prior to possibly about it.
Correct. And that goes back, I think, to what Judge Connolly mentioned is the what so-called merger clause in the purchase agreement that says all other discussions and understandings don't matter if they're not in the agreement, and it's not.
But in all fairness to Ms. Wickham, I mean, I think there is case law that says a merger clause cannot prohibit fraudulent misrepresentation.
I think you're right about that, Your Honor, but there's no fraudulent misrepresentation here. In the third statement, and Ms. Wickham made it early on, I think she said that part of their misrepresentation claim is a statement that my clients, open quote, intended to renew the leases, close quote. That is not, A, it was never said. B, it's not in their complaint. And if you look at paragraphs 58C and 58D of their amended complaint, they make very clear that they asked us to extend the terms of the leases, both MOSC and TCO, and MOSC and TCO declined. So Judge Werke and Judge Connolly, you both raised the point of how this may have been resolved by the documents. And there's a variety of ways it could have been resolved. The way it typically would be resolved, if a buyer of real estate insists on a longer term, a tenant staying in the premises for a longer term, they would require an amendment of the lease to extend the terms of the lease. Here they asked for that and we said no. So there can't be, in my view, any justifiable reliance on a comment that, gee, we'll discuss it later when you specifically ask for an extension and the answer is no. So those are the three things that I wanted to correct. And also a little more background, the sort of nature of their fraud claims is, gee, you weren't honest with us about the future. And to be clear, TCO is still in the premises today, 6 years later, and is paying its rent. So when we talk about future, there's nothing that's even false about what was said. To the extent that there were, as alleged in their complaint, comments about, we really are satisfied with the building, we intend to stay, we're not going anywhere. Those just aren't definite enough to base a fraud claim on under Minnesota law.
They're much Vivian, more- would you agree if instead of what is alleged your client said, your client said, we have no present intention to build a building in Blaine. And at the time, and try to throw it to the purchase agreement. And we have no intention of, we have no present intention of trying to get any of the tenants who are currently in this building over to our place when the building is built, right? So that's kind of the representation. I know that's kind of long.
Yeah.
And at the time you said it, you know, your people had plans, they had hired a contractor, you know, all that stuff. Would Ms. Wickhams have a claim for fraudulent misrepresentation even if there was this purchase agreement?
I can imagine the drafting of a specific representation as to a specific present intention that would create a fraud claim. I just don't think that's what we have here, Your Honor.
And there's no, I mean, in all the statements, I mean, I didn't see anything like along the lines of what I just said.
No, there is not. And to be clear, and I don't want to create a factual issue, but there was no intention to build a building in Blaine in 20, that is not true, but I don't want to create a factual issue.
Yeah.
I will say what is true and what they did know is that TCO was building buildings all over the metro. That's right in their amended complaint. So this notion that, gee, we didn't know they were building buildings, they absolutely knew that. I mean, all of us have driven around the metro and seen their billboards, they're everywhere. So to me, when you look at what was actually said, they're just open-ended statements about what may happen in the future. I mean, would appellants say that if we moved at any point ever, that it was fraud? That seems to be the offshoot of their argument, because the transaction closed in 2015 and MOSC didn't move until 2018. And TCO, as I mentioned, still hasn't moved and is intending to fulfill the lease terms through, I think it's 2024 or 2025.
Mr. Vivian, what about the, isn't there arguably, I mean, if the MRI equipment has been removed, isn't there arguably a conversion claim against TCO?
No, for at least two reasons I can think of, Your Honor. First, Judge Fountain Lindbergh found that the MRI equipment was not owned by appellants. So you can't convert something that the person doesn't own. As I think we mentioned earlier, my client didn't remove it.
It's the subtenant. What was the subtenant's name?
It's got a couple different DBA, Suburban Imaging, Suburban Radiology. We just call them Suburban.
Well, that in and of itself, Judge Connolly's question is why one of the complaints was seeking a declaratory judgment to try to figure out who's connected to who and where they went. You have any comment on that as far as being able to identify which parties are responsible or involved in which aspects of this?
Sure. I don't know why appellants are so focused on this. And I'll start with Suburban and then talk about the TCO entities. Suburban, they clearly know who Suburban is. They've sued them and they lost. So I don't think there's any confusion about whether the trade name of Suburban is imaging or radiology. There's not, in my view, shouldn't be any confusion about that. TCO, what happened, there was a bunch of surgeon groups came together to form what today is TCO. One of them was OPPA. So this is not a circumstance where they thought they had a lease with what I would call the parent entity, the big entity. And then it turns out it's with some subsidiary that doesn't have any assets. The surviving entity of all these mergers and corporate activities we admit and acknowledge is bound by those leases. So they have the surviving entity, the entity that has the assets, which is what any landlord would want. So at the end of the day, while it can be confusing and there's a bit of alphabet soup, I just don't think it matters. I see I have about 20 seconds left. Instead of getting another topic, I'll just let Ms. Ritoff have her time, unless your honors have any more questions for me.
No, thank you very much, Mr. Vivian. Ms. Ritoff, you may begin, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melissa Ritoff, and I represent the respondents, the Gaughan respondents, the Gaughan Companies, and Dan Hebert. With the short time I have, I will just rely on our submitted briefs. However, I do want to make a quick few points for the court. The Gaughan Companies is a separate entity from all of the other respondents. It's the real estate broker that assisted with the June 2015 sale on behalf of Northwestern Orthopedic Surgeons Partnership, or NOS.
And you have very little time, but I mean, Mr. Hebert was present when they had this April 2015 meeting, and that's where all these statements were apparently made, and Dr. Holmberg and Dr. Crandall were the ones that were affirmatively responding, but Hebert was there, right?
He was there, but appellants don't attribute any particular comment to Mr. Hebert during the meeting.
And the Judge Connolly asked a question previously, and it has to do with, you know, is there anything that we can ascribe to as far as assent by just sitting there and not retracting or disagreeing with what's being said? Are you aware of any case law that would allow us to follow that tack?
I am not, Your Honor. General allegations of assent are not particular enough, and we need to plead fraud with particularity. To be
there wasn't any
fraud.
Problem as far as dual agency representation in this case, right? Nobody brought that up, so I assume that wasn't even an issue.
No, the principal agent relationship was between NOSP and the Gaughan Companies and Dan Hebert. So it's undisputed that fraud has to be pleaded with particularity. The appellant should have argued fraud against the Gaughan respondents independently from the others, and this was not done, and this is why the court correctly dismissed the complaint against them. For example, with respect to the fraud allegations against the Gaughan respondents, knowledge of a principal is not automatically imputed to an agent. A realtor cannot be liable to the purchaser if he was simply repeating information gleaned from the seller. Also, for a representation to be actionable, it must be a false statement of past or present fact. A future action of a co-defendant can't be a basis for a fraud claim against the Gaughan respondents because it's not a past or present fact. And I also want to point out the complaint doesn't allege factual allegations against the Gaughan respondents after the sale. With this in mind, appellants fail to allege the Gaughan respondents had any independent knowledge.
But what about the confidential offering memorandum where it describes a property and talks about the tenants? Well, obviously you're familiar with it, you've reviewed it, but it talks about the tenants and the continuation of these leases into the future, producing a return on investment. Is that not enough at a pleading stage to survive the fraud dismissal?
It isn't, Your Honor, because the Gaughan respondents can only gather information that is known from the seller. And with respect to this particular complaint, they would have had to allege that the Gaughan respondents had some sort of independent knowledge outside of what the sellers told them.
And Ms. Ritoff, I mean, isn't there a specific disclaimer in the last page of the confidential offering memorandum that says they make no representation or warranty of any nature concerning without implementation, the correctness or completeness of the information?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's, I think,
well,
I'm
that does it for
time.
Me.
Thanks.
All right, Ms. Wickham, you have the last word, ma'am.
Thank you. I want to address the issues that arose in the other case because we haven't really talked about that head on. As I said, there's no final decision there. And I think it's important to remember, and I know you know this, but the issue here is, do the claim survive based on the amended complaint as pleaded, not on what we now know based on what happened later, or excuse me, what happened in the related litigation and those determinations. So these claims need to survive on their own, and our position is that they do. There does become a kind of practicality issue of what happens if the case is remanded, and I think that that can be dealt with on the first in the first instance by the district judges if this case is remanded, in terms of what is their discovery already done on, what discovery hasn't been done, and what needs to happen for the cases to both continue without a lot of overlap and inefficiencies.
But you know, as I always try to tell the clerks, there's, you know, appellate land, and then there's actually the world and the real world. And I mean, I guess, you know, if as to the MRI conversion claims, I mean, if we now know and you agree that, you know, it was the subtenant, Suburban, I hope this is right, who allegedly took this stuff, I mean, I would be, you know, well, you know, even though we all know that didn't happen, because it's Rule 12, we're gonna let it survive, so that the first thing that will happen then is that'll be dismissed back, you know, when this goes back to whoever the judge was, I can't remember. I mean, that just seems weird to me. I mean, wouldn't it make more sense to say, you know, as Ms. Wick, and you know, as the facts are and have been represented at oral argument, that's not true. So therefore we're not gonna take it as true because it's not. And I know what Rule 12 says, but you know, we have been presented with information in this oral argument in, you know, on November 3rd, that, you know, an allegation pled is no longer correct. So I guess I don't know why we'd say, well, you know, I mean, why would we do that? That just seems odd to me, Ms. Wickham.
I understand. I think the issue though is it's broader than who removed the MRI system. The issue is whether it was a fixture, and that was something that was decided in the related litigation, but it's also an appealable issue. And as Mr. Vivian said, it's not time to appeal that order. It's not final. And the rest of that case in front of the district court needs to wrap up before that can be appealed.
And you pled it was you pled it was a fixture owned by the purchaser in your complaint.
By the seller that was then transferred
the
purchaser.
Seller, I apologize.
Yes. Okay. Judge Werke, you had a question about somebody who I think used the phrase nodding their head is liable for fraud. And I wanted to point you to the Watkins versus Lorenz case, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case. And it's for reference cited on page 25 of our brief. There, Minnesota Supreme Court held that a landlord could be liable for fraud if he acquiesced by remaining silent while aware that the plaintiffs were being induced to enter a purchase agreement on the assumption that the lease might be extended for an additional 5 years from its expiration date, when he knew at the time that the lease would not be extended. And so I think here what we have is an issue of fact that needs to be dealt with in discovery and on the face of the pleadings that claim survives.
Well, in was the landlord the defendant in that case? In Walker, yes. In Watkins v. Lawrence?
I believe so.
Okay, but that's not a broker. I mean, that's the person who was part of, if the landlord was part of the purchase, if the landlord did what he did in that case, and he was a party to the purchase agreement, that's different from Ms. Rytoff's clients who were not a party to the purchase agreement, am I right?
Yes, but our allegations are that they also knew that the statements that were being made were not true.
When they nodded their heads?
Yes.
Or remained silent and didn't say, that's not true.
Right,
when they knew that it wasn't. They're building that Blaine building right as we speak.
Right.
Well, and I would just say, speaking for myself, I mean, if we held that's the law, I think we would jeopardize the entire real estate broker industry in America. But that's my opinion. So I did interrupt you, Ms. Wickham. Why don't you use the time to sum up?
I just wanted to thank you for your time and say that we do believe that the amended complaint is well pleaded on all the claims and ask for reversal and remand to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate all the hard work that was done by Ms. Wickham, Ms. Reithoff, Mr. Vivian. Thank you very much. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days. Thank you. Thank you.